This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hey everybody, it's Aaron Norris with the Norris Group. I am very excited today. We released this on Facebook to get some of your feedback on some questions you would like to ask Dr. Robin Zazio. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and licensed clinical social worker who has been specializing in the treatment of OCD and anxiety orders for probably over 20 years. You may recognize her from several different shows, but the one that I was introduced to her on was Hoarders, and I'm always just very fascinated by how calm and collected and patient you are with the people that you're working with. So thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. It's really always such a pleasure to be able to go on public venues to really be able to help the community better understand, not just hoarding disorder, which I specialize in, but also anxiety disorders.
Is it typical for being a licensed clinical psychologist and also social worker that I don't know if I've ever seen that combination. Is that unusual?
I don't think it's unusual. I think sometimes people go in one direction or another in that they want their doctorate, so they shoot straight through, or they're looking at being a licensed marriage family therapy or LCSW. Honestly, that was my initial goal. I hadn't really thought about my doctorate. But what happened was I got my license as a clinical social worker, and I didn't feel like I had the level of education that I really wanted to really be as proficient as I could. And so I literally went back to school, and that was my third degree.
Oh, my goodness. What was your third one?
Well, that was my doctorate. So I got my bachelor's and then my master's and then went back again and got my doctorate. So there was a much more streamlined way to do it. I could have just gone for the doctorate and gotten all three built into one, but I didn't. But I'm really happy I went back because it's really changed my life and I think really contributed to my abilities as a doctor.
You specialize in something very unusual. What attracted to you to this line of psychology and social work?
You know, it's interesting because I started out as somebody who was quite interested in forensic psychology, which really refers to those who commit crimes that are mentally ill. So, you know, there's lots of people in the media that we're seeing, you know, high-profile cases. And I was really fascinated by it. And when I got my doctorate and I was ready to graduate, I needed to get my postdoctoral hours. And I found an organization that was starting an OCD program, obsessive-compulsive disorder program. I knew nothing about it, and I thought, well, you know, this is kind of interesting. And 2 weeks in, I changed my complete course of direction because the treatment modalities are actually what we call evidence-based, meaning that we can prove that through giving people behavioral assignments to make change, it actually changes the brain chemistry, and there's nothing out there like it. So we were really able to produce change very quickly and help people restore their lives back to them.
That's interesting, and the reason I reached out, and I've never seen it done before, is we've gone from a market, say, in California in 2009, where our real estate investor community is working a lot with banks, and it's not very relational-focused, it's very transactional, to now almost exclusively we're working with people directly. And so the shift is extreme, and now it's not unusual at all for our industry to be working with somebody with a hoarder house. And, you know, some of the questions I got online is, what's the difference between someone who's just really messy and then somebody who has a disorder and then someone who's maybe in a really dark place and we should recognize the risk? So I would love to find out more about definitions of these things so we can talk about it more intelligently and spot the bad stuff.
Absolutely. Well, if people are not familiar with my book, it's called The Hoarder in You, How to Live a Happier, Healthier, Uncluttered Life. And there is a lot of information in there to really understand the difference between someone who, as you're saying, Aaron, is messy versus they're just a clutterer. And maybe have difficulty with organization versus the spectrum going up to somebody who has hoarding disorder. And the when we talk about hoarding disorder, we're talking about somebody who has a level of acquisition of things that reaches a point where areas in the house cannot be used for the purpose in which they're intended. So they can no longer, you know, prepare meals because there's so much stuff on the countertops, that rooms are not accessible because there's so much stuff, that there are narrow pathways that even can prevent safety issues because of the amount of stuff. And of course, there's all different degrees, but hoarding disorder reaches that level where there is that impairment in functioning. And oftentimes we're also seeing an impairment psychologically as well, meaning that there is increased isolation, there's increased depression, there's increased estrangement from family members, because if that person has let a family member in the home, of course, they're getting a lot of flack. Why are you living like this? What is wrong with you? Why can't you clean up? And they get to a point where they don't want to hear it anymore. And the family members don't understand that hoarding disorder, and Aaron, this is so key, is a form of mental health condition. It is a mental disorder. Mm. And so if they could just clean up, they would. If they could curb the acquisition of items, they would. It's sort of like going to someone who's depressed and saying, knock it off. Quit being depressed.
Yeah.
Stop having suicidal thoughts.
Right.
What's wrong with you? You know what I mean? And people don't think about it that way. And I think one of the reasons why is because depression is so accepted, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's been around for so long. And when people look at individuals who are struggling with their stuff and letting it overtake their home, there's this logical part of, this doesn't make any sense. You know, why would you live like this? But if we can all go into this place of understanding that, no, it's not logical, and it's a mental health condition that causes somebody's brain to engage in these ways, we can maybe have a little bit more compassion and understanding and sympathy, and not blame and judge, calling them lazy or uncaring or unsympathetic. And that's really, I think, the key difference. And that's why I do so much activity across the country trying to promote awareness, because people are not going to accept help if they feel like they're going to be met with judgment rather than understanding.
That's a great point. And I think you might have a similar... At what point would somebody call you? What's going on in their lives? Because I think it would probably mirror why we're, as real estate investors, are getting called, because something is, what's going on in the background? Is it family? Is it the health department coming on top? Like, in your experience, what's the trigger point where something has to change?
You know, historically, individuals struggling with hoarding disorder, hoarding behaviors, don't seek help because of the shame and the embarrassment and the fear that code enforcement, fire department, police department, adult protective services, child protective services are going to come down on them. And they don't really realize that these institutions are not designed to be punitive, as they are actually designed to be helpful, right?
Mm, yeah.
When you know, we're in trouble and we feel unsafe, we call the police to help us, right? We don't
right.
think that they're going to come and hurt us. And so, but it's kind of turned around because they're so afraid of what they're going to think about them. So they don't let people in their houses, and they completely avoid. And so the problem gets worse and worse. And family members don't know what to do. Sometimes what they think is helpful is, you know, if they're on vacation, if their family member's on vacation, they'll go in and clean up their house, not realizing that that is one of the most detrimental things that they can do. I give the analogy of, you know, Aaron, if you went on vacation and someone thought that your house should be cleaned up and that you had too much stuff, and you come back and someone has made decisions about what you need and what you don't need, you know, that would be pretty devastating.
Yeah.
You know, and even though perhaps it is true that a person struggling with this condition might have things that are broken, unusable, you know, not really necessary, if you will, it's still their stuff.
You said something interesting, is that there's a cognition that if they ask for help, there could be, how did you phrase it? There's a cognition that something's probably not normal, that they're doing behavior that's causing like health issues. So they're afraid to reach out for the embarrassment or whatever. But logically, are they in their mind thinking, I'm just a collector. I really like this stuff and all this stuff is important. there's just two conversations going on. That's interesting.
You know, interestingly enough, one of the cases in which has been showcased on TV, a gentleman back east who, and of course I'm in California, who had over 200,000 beer cans, okay, beer cans. And he, you know, was adamant, I am a collector. Now, he had other collectibles as well, but he was adamant that he was a collector. Now, I want you to envision walking into a space where there are 200,000 beer cans. You'd have to be incredibly organized and strategic to be able to, you know, take care of them. And when we're walking in, what do you think we're doing? You know, we're stepping on them. We're squashing them. We're destroying them. Of course, not intentionally, but there's no place else to walk because he ran out of space, and therefore, you know, they just kind of invaded the entire floor. And as much as we were trying to be careful and cautious, there was no place else to walk. Like, we couldn't help him if we weren't able to get in. And of course, we were very apologetic. And he insisted, I am a collector. And so what we're explaining to people is a collector is very strategic, right? When they go out, they might, you know, let's say they're collecting Barbie dolls, right? Mm-hmm. They don't collect every single Barbie doll they see. If one has a broken arm, they might say, oh, I really can't do much with this, rather than just say, it's a Barbie doll, so I'm going to buy it, you know?
Right.
I already have this one. This isn't helpful for my collection. I'm really looking for that one or two pieces that are going to make my collection. And a collector also can care for the items. They can protect the items. They might have them boxed. They might have them shelved in a nice cabinet where they can display them and say, hey, look, here's my stuff. But when people are more struggling with the excessive acquisition, it doesn't mean that in their mind, as you're asking, that they're not thinking, oh, I am a collector. But when it gets to that place, and this is really the key, that your space is invaded and you cannot live a life in which you are safe. And this is another key component, especially for your listeners, that the community isn't safe. That's a problem, right? Because they're not thinking my place could go up in flames.
Right.
They're not thinking that the fact that I haven't, you know, fixed these appliances, or there are wires hanging out, that that could produce an electrical problem, that that not only puts me in danger, but also the community. They don't think that far ahead. And so part of what we try to explain to them is that, you know, your home is your castle. And I get that you're saying that you want all this stuff and you like this stuff, and that maybe even you're not particularly bothered by having to sort of develop some goat skills of climbing over mounds of stuff and you know, narrow pathways that we call goat paths. You know, I get that, but this is the deal. You know, if you had a medical problem, would a gurney be able to get in to save you? You know, if not, let's just say you can't get to the phone, would you be able to get out of the house? And on top of that, if your house, you know, if they're in an apartment, it puts their neighbors at risk.
Yeah.
If they're in a condo, you know, and so these are all things that we really have to take into consideration. And it's at these points that they, that code enforcement will come in and fine and cite them and give them an allocated amount of time to get their house in order. And gosh, Aaron, you know, that's not the best way, you know, being trapped in a corner saying, if you don't do this, you're going to be locked out of your home.
Yeah, because it, does it induce change, or does it just fear you comply, but it doesn't ultimately fix what's going on underneath?
Well, that all depends on what happens next. So when we go out into the community, and if we need a crew to start helping us get the massive amount of stuff out, you want to, as much as possible, have a mental health professional there because, you know, again, if they could get rid of the stuff, they would. So just sending a crew in to start bringing out the stuff is not gonna work. So typically the best thing, and this is the ideal world, but it doesn't always work out that way. Typically the best way is that they can get into therapy first and understand what is leading to all the acquisition of items and how they can start to make good decisions about what to let go of. And like anything, when we can feel empowered to make those decisions ourselves, then we feel good about ourselves. But when someone says, look, you've got 30 days, and if you don't do this, you know, they're a caged lion. They're terrified and they're scared, and they might, out of force, you know, get rid of stuff. But the propensity for them to bring the items back again is very, very high because they haven't really learned anything.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine. And by the time when you get called in, I don't know if we fully got back to this, is when you're doing the show, is it because the family members are reaching out because they need help? Is it triggered by the family or is it triggered by somehow the city law enforcement in some way?
It can be a combination of things. Recently, we went out to an extremely dangerous situation because of the level of fecal matter in the home, and it was not under the radar of code enforcement or any other enforcement agencies. It was at the request of the family because the loved one ended up in the hospital, and it wasn't until then that they realized that it was so dangerous. And so when we're called out, it is always in some way a pretty extreme and emergency type situation. So it's never easy. And of course, what you see when you watch the show is incredibly extreme and dramatic. It's interesting, Aaron, because sometimes people have said, do you guys stage that? And it's like,
no.
No. In fact, when I walk in the house, what you see and what I see is first eyes on. I have gotten information, so obviously I have a sense of what I'm headed for, but when my eyes walk in, we're all seeing the same thing. And, you know, it's what I do. So, you know, when you say how can you remain so calm? Well, you know, first of all, I'm the doctor. I'm not the family member. And I don't think that any one of us can really imagine what it's like to live with a family member or to have a family member who's going through this. It's so incredibly painful. But what I know is that I'm going to get a lot further with that person if I can meet them at their level, at their anxiety, at their fear, at their desire to, you know, get their home cleaned up, if they are, and if they're not, if they're feeling forced into it, to help them get to a place where they can understand why it has gotten so overwhelming and what we can do to try to help them.
I guess that leads into the really next conversation. Is it born or is it learned? There's so many different types of disorders. Maybe we'll have time in the next show to cover that a little bit. But what's the trigger point? Like, how does it start?
So that's a lot of what I cover in my book as well, that, you know, it's not just, you know, I talk about how, you know, when the teacher in high school says, what do you want to be when you grow up? People don't say, you know what, I want to suffer from hoarding disorder. And I want to have a lot of stuff and have, you know, enforcement agencies down my back and CPS threatening to take my children away. Like, people don't make those decisions, right?
Of course.
So now we go back to the question of, is this nature versus nurture? Nature is, you know, the chemicals in our body, our genetics. Nurture is the environment that we're raised in. And the thing is you can't always necessarily tease it out, because if you have the nurture part, meaning you were raised in that environment, then that really suggests that there's a genetic predisposition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are lots of people who grow up in families who say that, no, you know what, I actually grew up in a really clean home, or my mother was really organized, or this, that, or whatever. And so you don't see that lineage, but we can oftentimes see other triggers like trauma, you know, abuse or loss. Many times we're seeing family members that pass away and they can't make decisions about what to keep and what to get rid of. And so they hold on. They bring everything into their house with a plan to sort through it. But when they start to touch it and look at it and the memories come up, it's so painful for them. And they almost want to go to this place of, what would my mother or what would my father, or my aunt or brother want me to keep and get rid of? And, of course, they can't answer that question
right,
because they can't talk or communicate to them. And so they get very paralyzed and they put it aside. And procrastination is what we call one of the biggest offenders to this process, because they put it off thinking, I'm going to get to it later, but later never comes because they have what we call anticipatory anxiety, meaning when they think about having to do that, it becomes so overwhelming that they put it off. And then, of course, with all of the other items that they have in their house and all the other demands that they have between family and work and commitments, you know, it's easy to put off the things that are more difficult. I always tell people, you know, when you wake up in the morning, you don't think, oh my gosh, I can't wait to go clean the cat box, right? I mean, that's like the very last thing that you want to do, because it's uncomfortable, it's smelly, and it's stinky and all of that. But it just kind of, you know, illustrates that it's human behavior to put off the things that are comfortable for you.
Fair enough. That's it. That is fair. Well, you know, we only got a couple minutes left of this segment. I want to save that for the next show, because I know that's going to be beefy. Let's just, I guess, tie this piece up with, in your experience as you're working with people, what's the percentage of people that can go on and lead normal lives if they go through the appropriate process of sort of working through this?
That's a really good question. So unfortunately, the research right now is still in process. Historically, we didn't have a lot of information because people were living in silence, but it really is because of the media now showcasing this condition that more people are seeking help and we're getting a better sense of the condition. But unfortunately, the statistics now are 90% of individuals who do get their house in order recidivate, meaning they go back to the behaviors.
Oh, wow.
And those are, those are really similar to the statistics of like alcoholism, you know, people going through treatment and the percentages of people that actually stay clean and sober. It's not real high. And so with any condition, there are some things that we would look at in terms of one's prognosis. One is their motivation to change. Is there an intrinsic, an internal desire to change versus being forced? You know, so if you look at somebody who's got a substance abuse problem, you know, if you don't get help, I'm leaving you. Okay, all right, I'll get help. You know,
right.
But they're not really thinking, you know, oh my gosh, look at what, you know, my behavior has done to our relationship. Wow, you know, again, they're forced in the corner. So we really have to look at motivation to change, that intrinsic desire. And then being able to openly work with somebody and apply the things that they're teaching them. And the critical part is that after they get their home cleaned up, that they have a plan, that, you know, they do things like, if they're in the grocery store, they have a list, that they don't just buy things, you know, because it sounds good, that they check the refrigerator before they go out and realize that, oh, wow, I forgot I had leftover pizza from last night. You know what? I don't need to go to the store.
We all need to be doing that.
Oh, yeah. No, seriously. Yeah. I mean, I just talked to somebody on Monday who said that they discovered year-old cookies in their pantry, mm-hmm. you know, like, you know, and so there's so many things that they can do, you know, not stop in stores that they know are triggering, the dollar store, clearance store, and they're not buying things needlessly. And then to do follow-up care to be sure that it's not just looking at this. This is not about a cleanup process. Like I say that all the time. This is not about cleaning up your home. It's about getting at why you struggle with being able to say no to the temptation of items, to not be able to limit yourself, to ensure that you only bring something into your house if it has a home in your house.
That's a good way to phrase it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because, you know, I'm standing here and, you know, I've got a completely clear floor space, but, you know, just because there's a couch that's 75% off, I'm not going to bring it in because there's actually floor space. It needs to have an actual home that is, you know, for its purpose, you know, that's going to be usable. And then, you know, really following through with everything that they've learned and staying on top of themselves through having accountability, whether it be a therapist or a family member, you know, making sure that someone is coming into their house every single week, literally, you know, for a period of time to make sure, you know, that they're staying on top of things, because it's easy to get comfortable again in the dysfunctional ways that were what they know. You know, if it's common that a couple just, you know, tends to argue about every little thing that comes up, they have to work really hard to not argue, to listen, to not be defensive. And it sounds like, oh, that would be the easy thing to do, right? That's you know, that's how you communicate. But when you've been living or interacting in dysfunction for so long, that's just what you know, and it becomes easier.
Well, we are out of time for this segment, but if they wanted to get a hold of you or find out more about you and your book, where would they go?
Of course. So I'm at the Anxiety Treatment Center. We have offices in Sacramento, Roseville, El Dorado Hills. You can always email me if you have questions. It's drrobin@atcsac.net, drrobin@atcsac.net. Of course, our phone number is 916-366-0647. And you can find our website at anxietytreatmentexperts.com. And the book is The Hoarder in You, How to Live a Happier, Healthier, Uncluttered Life. And you can find it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.